This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Amat Fuad Rama, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts that better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope will shed light on the world around you. Unfortunately, Fuad could not be here today, but in his place, we have Sumit Mandal. He is a historian at Institut Kajian Malaysia dan Antarabangsa at UKM, or Universiti Kebangsaan Malaysia. Sumit, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Sumit, last week marks the first anniversary of the death of William Roth. He was, of course, a famous historian. You studied under him, and his work had an influence on you. Could you, you know, begin this discussion with some kind of personal words about the man himself?
I studied at Columbia University at the undergraduate level as well. And at that time, I began to take classes on Southeast Asia. And William Roth was the only professor of Southeast Asian studies, in this case, a professor of history in the history department at Columbia. And I got to know him in undergraduate courses and got interested in pursuing a doctoral degree with him.
Was he a very dynamic teacher? Was he pacing up and down the front of the class, you know, lecturing their students? I mean, what was he like intellectually? Was he demanding?
Yeah, I think he was certainly demanding. He would not look at students, especially at graduate seminars and so on, happily had they come unprepared. He was not necessarily physically dynamic, but I think he was very thoughtful and dynamic in terms of the kinds of ideas that he dealt with.
So you, in your graduate years, he was your supervisor.
That's right.
And you were working on, what exactly were you working on then?
Well, my PhD thesis was on Arab migrations and settlement in Java under Dutch colonial rule, mostly the 19th century.
And did he direct you in to take on that kind of topic?
No, but he gave me ideas. He had been one of the few scholars who in the 50s and 60s had paid attention to Arab Muslim communities in this part of the world. He'd written a couple of essays where he touched on topics like that, and he certainly introduced me to the presence and importance of Arab Muslims in this part of the world. And I began to then think about it in relation. He'd written on Singapore, actually, a short essay on a murder case in Singapore of an Al-Kaf, member of the Al-Kaf family. And I got interested instead in Arabs in Indonesia and turned my attention there. But certainly he had a role to play in introducing me to the topic.
Now, he's well known in this country, at least, for his work on Malay nationalism, and the book is The Origins of Malay Nationalism. Could you say a little bit about that work, and to what extent has that work eclipsed the other kinds of work that he's done, or he did in his lifetime?
The Origins of Malay Nationalism came out of his PhD thesis, and it was published in 1967. Now, it was really a pioneering piece of work for a number of reasons. Some claim that it was the first real history of Malays following independence. So there were histories of British Malaya and of other colonial topics, but a topic that was related to Southeast Asian society after independence, and of course dealing with nationalism. And it was also important because it worked with the types of sources that prior to people like Bill Roth, that generation of scholars who finished their PhDs in the 1960s, were not often looked at. A whole range of newspapers in the Malay language written in the Jawi script, in conjunction with colonial archives. And as a result, he really did come up with a perspective rooted in what people were saying then, were regarding then as an Asian-centered history. as opposed to the colonial types of histories prior to that.
Can I ask you one last personal question? Was he happy to have a student from Malaysia, a country that he had worked on decades before?
Yes, I think it meant something to him to have not just myself, other students who had studied with him from Malaysia. I meant to also say something about whether the book had been eclipsed. The book has been the primary focus of many Malaysian readers. So when Bill Roth was last year in 2009 to launch his last book, which I will introduce later as my recommendation for this session of Night School, he was plagued by questions on the origins of Malay nationalism. Practically no one touched on the work that he did for decades after. And he handled them as gracefully as possible. But I think, it's an indication of how sometimes scholars get pegged in particular ways. Among scholars in Europe and the US, Bill Roth came to be known as a scholar of Muslim societies, as a person who, in conjunction with others, was involved in introducing some critical thinking to the way in which Muslim societies was being approached.
Well, that's fascinating on one level, because we assume that when scholars look at societies, they do it with some level of critical thinking. The idea that a scholar might then come after and say, well, all this work that had gone before me lacked something, or was they had blind spots, or what was the nature of this particular critique that he did? And maybe we could start with naming the essay that you want to talk about.
Yes, an important aspect of William Roth's work, besides the origins of Malay nationalism, I'm going to discuss an essay that he wrote in 1985 called Islam Obscured: Some Reflections on Studies of Islam and Society in Southeast Asia. And this is quite a dense essay which is quite critical of the ways in which categories are sometimes used far too simplistically.
How would you characterize a simplistic category? It seems that categories are by their nature fairly neat, and I mean and that purpose is to bring order to the world, right? So if they weren't in some ways simple, they would lose the function of being a category.
Okay, let's think about the ways in which Islam in Southeast Asia has been reduced by the use of categories in far too simplistic ways. I don't think that William Roth was talking about the dismissal of all forms of categories or all forms of generalizations and analysis. For the longest time, and scholars have viewed Islam as in Southeast Asia as a faith that did not have a great deal of depth, that it had been absorbed only superficially. There are reasons for this which we could look at a little bit more perhaps, but there's a substantial history to this idea that somehow Islam was a superficial accretion in Southeast Asian archipelago. And related to this was the notion that a more true version of Islam existed in the centers of Islamic scholarship and faith, namely Mecca, Medina, and also Cairo. So there was frequently this idea of a center and a periphery. And William Roth was one among a number of scholars who raised questions about this kind of center-periphery notion. And in fact, he makes a very interesting comment about how the textual precepts in Islam relate to different societies across the world. I'll read an excerpt that I think is quite relevant. He writes, quote, "If it be accepted that the Sharia points to a discoverable but unrealizable ideal of great and dynamic complexity, it follows that all Islamic societies, from the first generation in Arabia to the Indonesia or Morocco, or for that matter, Arabia of the present, can exist only in approximation to that ideal. I found this a very helpful idea, Sharia, which in fact in Arabic actually means the revealed way of God, is another category that gets reduced far too easily as Islamic law. It's actually a far more dynamic forms of advice and that have been recorded across time and are open to interpretation by legal scholars.
So the reduction is happening by whom? Is it the scholars who are reducing the notion of Sharia to law, or is it the folk that actually practice the religion who now remember it or deploy the word Sharia as law?
See, the purpose of William Roth's essay here is a critique of the scholarship that is reductionist. And the scholars who make these reductionist claims, who claim that somehow Malay or Javanese Muslims weren't true Muslims, are usually resting their assumption on the notion that they are not orthodox in their practices. And now, in answer to that, William Roth's article actually suggests, quoting other scholars, that when a Muslim proclaims himself or herself as Muslim, then it is our work to, as scholars, to take that seriously, not our work, on the other hand, to suggest that, well, you know, to decide for Muslims who are actually practicing with greater orthodoxy in comparison to others. So the quote that I read, I think, is very helpful because it makes us look at Sharia, the revealed way of God, as it is often translated in good and accurate translations from the Arabic, as an ideal. And this textual ideal is found in different parts of the world, but it is realized in complex ways, across the world, because it engages with very different contexts. So when you take it from this perspective, you don't have a privileged position for Arabs necessarily compared to Indonesians or Malays. And you might find, in fact, that in some instances, the practices in our part of the world might actually adhere more closely to a particular kind of orthodoxy compared to some Arab practices.
So here the first critique is the deployment of categories that do not help you understand adequately what's actually happening on the ground. So this is a fault that scholars might be accused of in the way they present Islam. Now, we're going to come back with more discussion on the kinds of problems that William Roth saw in the scholarship on Islam of his time. Right after this, you've been listening to Sumit Mandal, myself, Sharad Kutin, on Night School, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. Welcome back to Night School. Together with me is Sumit Mandal. He is a historian at Institut Kajian Malaysia Antarabangsa at Universiti Kebangsaan Malaysia. He was also the student of William Roth, a man well known for a book he wrote many years ago called The Origins of Malay Nationalism. Today, Sumit is speaking about his other work, his work on Islam, for which, at least in this part of the world, I understand, is less known. Sumit, you in the first part talked about his critique of a certain reductionist tendency among scholars of Islam looking at Islam in this part of the world, in Southeast Asia. What are the other things that Roth noticed about his fellow scholars in their depictions of representations of Islam?
Well, I think what he suggests in this article, Islam Obscured, is that there was a tendency to produce neat generalizations and theories based on very slim evidence. He wasn't against the need for generalizations, but he felt that there was a strong need for an ethnographic insistence, and I'm quoting again, an ethnographic insistence on people and place combined with a recognition that all social actuality has particular historical roots. So he felt that theory had to be substantially guided by the historical diversity and shape of Muslim societies at different moments. And too many scholars were producing, for instance, notions of a particular, say, that Javanese Islam took a particular shape in the 19th century based on very little scholarly evidence.
Now, the scholars that he was reading or looking at, critiquing, as I understand it, are not, kind of minor names in the field. They're actually quite well-known scholars, right? So in many ways, this was a really powerful critique, because he's taking on the best minds and the most prominent writers of his time on the question of Islam and pointing to them blind spots, perhaps. Where did this impulse to generalize come from? Was it something that is in the discipline? Was it that scholars of that time felt the need to reach for grand sort of theories, having spent time in the field, however long or little?
Yeah, among the scholars that William Roff is offering a critique of here is Clifford Geertz, who's a very well-known anthropologist. And I think his work is taken seriously, and it's not that William Roff finds that everything in the work is particularly wrong, but he's concerned with the generalizations that are made, not just by him but by others, and how they continue to be reproduced because of their scholarly authority. So sometimes, yes, it is the impulse to produce theory that, and frequently, that a type of theorization that works within particular audiences, perhaps in particular circles in the U.S. at a particular time. And, there was a time in the 80s and 90s when in scholarship at least, it was felt that, theorizing ruled, and the type of work that many people did in area studies and so on was understood to be retrograde, it produced a lot of empirical evidence which didn't come together. It was all a mess that didn't come together in powerful theories that help us to both understand the world and maybe change things. But I think the type of nuanced critique that people like William Roff are doing is bringing the need for the type of area studies depth to improve on the kinds of theorizing that's taking place.
So maybe we could just pause for a moment and just step away from the question of William Roff's critique and say, what is the distinction, do you think, Sumit, between a work that is descriptive but analytical and a work that is essentially theoretical? And therefore analytical. I mean, what do you think is the difference there?
Well, I think they do different things. So a work that is theoretical, and say, for instance, perhaps one could think about many of the philosophical texts that you've been discussing in night school, work from suppositions about social realities and so on. I don't think they are necessarily completely removed from social realities. But works that are descriptive, or to use a term that's often connected with anthropology or sociology, ethnographic, attempt to work with field research materials or contact with people, observations of people, in conjunction with historical texts that tell us something about their past, and thereby produce generalizations and theories. So I think works that are more theoretical do things differently from works that are based much more in empirical reality. But the need for theory, the need for forming overall generalizations, I was recently reminded, is so important. In an interview with Stuart Hall, who just passed away, and he talks about how society is huge. It's a multitude of people and individuals and so on. And the work of scholars is to go in and to find ways of finding of being able to understand this diversity, to come up with insights and so forth. And I think good theory then in some form reflects those social realities, you know. And I think in that sense, again, they could good philosophical theory, good theorizing that is done outside of, say, a social scientific framework might be very helpful in terms of honing one's thinking about a particular topic, but it's not necessarily anchored in that social reality.
Coming back to William Roth now, I mean, what else was he concerned about when he looked at the scholarship? And clearly by the time he was writing this essay, there was a huge body of scholarship that had built up on the question of Islam in Southeast Asia.
Yes, I think more broadly, I should say that when he was writing, this essay was published in 1985, but I think he could be included among scholars who were seeking to provide clarity and balance in the scholarship on Islam, when in the US especially, where he was teaching, the dominant view reduced Islam to a rabid fundamentalism, you know, the term in the 1970s and 80s, before the 2001 attacks on New York and Washington, was fundamentalism, and it was related to other geopolitical problems that the United States faced in relation to the oil-producing countries in the Arabic-speaking world. So he was very concerned in classroom situations and so on with what does this word mean? You know, how can this word not only be reproduced in the mass media quite effectively to racialize Muslims as a kind of a negative category. And in conjunction with that, he was also taking up the challenge set up by Edward Said. Edward Said, like William Roth, was teaching at Columbia University at the time. He had written his book, Orientalism, in 1978, and laid the groundwork for a lasting critique of reductionist views of Islam. But for social science scholars such as William Roth, what do we now do? You know, how do we become better scholars when we approach Muslim societies? And it's in this struggle, both in teaching and doing research, that he ends up writing the article that I propose for today. And I think one of the solutions that he finds is very careful generalizations made based on historical context and place-specific studies. One which allowed for both understanding Islam as a global faith, but understanding Muslim societies, a whole range of diverse believers responding to the precepts available in the Sharia in different ways.
Now, you mentioned a particular work that he written on Singapore trial of a murder, right? Yeah, you said of a Hadhrami individual, right? What other specific works did he write? I mean, was he concerned with particular histories or periods with regard to Islam in Southeast Asia? Or did he write in sort of these general terms about the concept of Islam in Southeast Asia?
No. In this essay, it is a much more general critique, but he's also written articles on onomastics and taxonomies of belonging in the Malay Muslim world. So
I don't know if you're allowed to say that word on air, Sumit. Onomastics, could you explain that, please?
Yes, I should probably then say forms of naming.
Aha.
Yes. So he studied categories, lists of names that he'd found to try to see if there was a pattern of Muslim naming that in this part of the world. Another article which came out of, I think, classes that he taught in the mid-80s when I was at Columbia, it's called Islamic Movements, One or Many. And I think they're again reacting to this idea of fundamentalism, leveling people off. I think, you know, the broader struggle he as a scholar, intellectual, he was involved in was and his and the reason for his emphasis on historical specificity and place was to avoid the damages of categorization, the damaging t- types, the damaging implications of categorization, meaning forms of racialization and alienation of entire groups of people by those who are in control of knowledge and resources. He's also written about the Malay Muslim world of Singapore at the end of the 19th century, a very interesting essay about what, you know, Pranakan, Jawi Pranakan, people we might today call Mamak, the Arab Pranakan, and the ways in which they there was an interaction between in a Muslim public sphere within Singapore that was not particularly ethnicity based.
What were you particularly fascinated by or attracted to in his work?
I learned a great deal about writing history in a both a challenging and critical way. So I think in this essay as well, he's quite critical of scholars, especially of the colonial tradition, who might have written enormous works but weren't particularly strong on interpretation. I think William Roth was an historian who cared a lot about careful interpretation and also an insistence on, like many good area studies scholars, on learning the context really well, learning languages and becoming familiar. So it's a careful balance between that empirical knowledge and forming sound generalizations.
So, Sumit, you know, I guess for a lot of us who are not in the social sciences or don't deal with issues of category and generalizations, this might seem a little abstract. I mean, how powerful are these categories in shaping the way we understand things? If you change the very basis of framing, as it were, of your understanding, what kind of different story would you come up with? You know, so if you had an example, that would be great.
If you remember, I spoke about how there is a tradition of scholarship on this part of the world in which the claim is made that Islam was never very deeply internalized by Malay and Javanese Muslims. Now, that notion is linked to a center-periphery idea. Given that this is the periphery, you know, as people converted to Islam in this part of the world, it never quite, for a number of other reasons as well, never quite became as deeply held as, say, it might be in the Arabian Peninsula, the center, so to speak. Now, this type of idea has taken a more contemporary form and is sometimes expressed also in the language of moderates and extremists today. Many people, especially following the attacks on the U.S. in 2001, the bombing of the dramatic attack on the Twin Towers in New York, for instance, the idea emerged of a moderate versus extremist Islam, and an idea that had roots in colonial and post-independent scholarship was revived in another form, and we found people writing about the Indonesia and Malaysia as moderate states, and the problem in the eyes, especially of people working in the interests of the United States, was with the more extremist Islam of the Arabic-speaking world. Now, we also find today, some 10 years after those dramatic events in 2001, more than a decade after those events, leaders in the region using this language as well. Now, what this language does is it blinds us sometimes, and it's very attractive as a because it's simple, it's very assimilable, and maybe it also reflects some truths. But it can also blind us from the questions that we are faced with. For instance, if we are thinking about political Islam, a topic many scholars work on, we realize that there have been movements and even attacks on public spaces in Indonesia by groups claiming to be radical Muslims and so forth, that notions of political radicalism that ought to be seen for what they are, as political ideas that have a transnational reach, move across boundaries and defy notions of moderate versus extremists. Moderate versus extremists could be reflective of a category of politics that a particular government wishes to espouse, but it doesn't necessarily reflect the way in which Muslim societies are constituted. So I would say there is a whole range of faith practices and diversity within the Muslim societies we are in particular concerned with today, maybe Malaysia and Indonesia. And within these communities, there are various kinds of tendencies. And I think some people actually were surprised when forms of political violence based on Islam emerged in the Indonesian context, because they had so long held to the view that these were moderate and mild Muslims and not prone to political violence.
Right, so the lens through which scholars viewed a particular society foreclosed certain possibilities they could not anticipate, in fact, or they were, and then I think this happens all the time, right? Scholars are blindsided by their own theories of a society, and when events change, or they're caught off guard, as it were, they could never sense what was coming in the future.
But I think it's also traditions of scholarship that become somewhat hegemonic. They become so well established that one finds it hard to break out of the mold. And I think what William Roth does in this article is try to break out of the mold. And these traditions of scholarship also become the basis upon which sometimes governments and intelligence specialists and others base their own work on, and as a result, you could have not just scholarly misunderstandings, but potentially fatal misunderstandings of what is happening in society.
And misunderstandings that inform policy. That's now, right. What kind of response did Roth get to this article, especially from the scholars that he identified in his work?
I can't really say about the scholars who are the object of his criticism here. I think it's a very balanced criticism, and if it's not really an attack. But I do know that his work has been very influential among scholars some of his peers, as well as his doctoral students, including myself, and in Indonesia in particular. Here, I think in Malaysia, because of the origins of Malay nationalism, in many ways, Malaysian readers haven't looked at his scholarship on Islam. And I should say he tended to say Muslim societies rather than Islam. It's another way of being careful in his generalization. So, but in Indonesia, I think many Indonesian scholars have taken on and also used his work in trying to produce generalizations about Muslim societies that are more nuanced and empirically based.
Distinction for us. What's the difference between saying a Muslim society and saying an Islamic one?
These are the types of semantics that could end up being meaningless, but I think we need to look at it from what I think he was trying to get across to his students and in his work. It was an emphasis on people and agents within a larger faith, rather than the abstraction, the faith itself, which frequently comes to be portrayed as an abstraction, as a set of beliefs that's unchanging. And if you remember, with the reference to the Sharia, even there, in the Islamic tradition, it's a dynamic set of opinions that show the divine way, and that gets reduced to Islamic law.
That's very interesting, because I guess when you work the other way around, from Islam to the society, or any category of that sort, you assume that people, the individuals, are some cultural automatons. They work out the religion through them. The religion speaks to them rather than them deploying, using, negotiating with that larger tradition, right? That would be the distinction.
That's right. That's right.
So, okay. Is Roth easy to read?
Well, unfortunately, I picked an essay that was a bit difficult because the references to other scholars and traditions of scholarship was quite dense. But I find otherwise, for instance, Origins of Malay Nationalism is lauded for its clarity. Many of his other essays are wonderful to read. And I thought I might recommend a book that's easily available in this region. It's his last collection of essays. It's called, and his last book, Studies on Islam and Society in Southeast Asia. It was published in 2009 by NUS Press in Singapore.
And Roth is in his 80s when he's published this book, isn't he?
He was approaching 80 when he published the book.
Right. So I guess in this sense, this episode of Night School kind of honors the man and his work. And thank you so much, Sumit, for being on with us. And we will post references to the book so that people who are interested in it might pick it up.
Thank you, Sharon.
All right. You've been listening to Sumit Mandal. He is a historian at Institut Kajian Malaysia dan Antarabangsa at Universiti Kebangsaan Malaysia. And I'm Sharad Kutin. As always, this has been Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.